Hello.
Hello, David.
It's David speaking.
Can you hear me, David?
I sure can.
Oh, this is Jeremy calling.
Hi, Jeremy. Great to hear from you.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. We finally connect.
Yeah.
Instead hilarious.
Instead of emailing like crazy.
Yes. Sir, are you calling from New York City?
Yep, right here in Queens, New York.
Queens, New York. Have you finished your shift for the...
I did a kind of like escaping after lunch kind of thing with my sous chef.
Good.
Yeah. So how are things going up there? Good?
Yeah, things are going very good. It's very, very chaotic. It's usually pretty chaotic, and now it's getting really, really chaotic.
Yeah, I mean, 12 different breads. What are you, going crazy?
Yeah, well, you know what they say, diversify, eh?
Yeah, really.
But it's sort of true. It's you know, instead of making pain au levain,
yeah,
and only pain au levain, I started making, semolina levain, and
right.
What was the other one I did? Organic spelt. And so I did sell a lot of each one, but when you combine them together, you know, the numbers went up.
Wow, that's good.
We got a little bit of publicity, like I was mentioning in the email. There was a girl from CBC Radio, which is like a government-run radio station.
Right.
I listen sometimes in the mornings when we're doing bakes to this guy that does a show, and so I'm trying to be a little bit of a media hound, you know. So I sent some stuff to him, and he checked out the blog and became interested, and he had a new intern columnist that was starting a column on what people do with their weekends, and so she came out and interviewed us, and it was really great, and
that's cool.
We got good response, and so like that also put the numbers up as well.
Wow.
So how
does that work out with work, though?
With what?
With your regular job.
Oh, well, we have these things called sick days, right?
Oh, yeah.
Which, I'm obviously not supposed to be taking sick days to do this, but that's what I did this past weekend. We normally do bakes only on Sundays because we're both off. My wife is off and I'm off.
Yeah.
And the bake we did on the weekend, I decided, you know what, I'm going to need more than one day. It's just going to be too much for one day. So I'll start firing the oven on Friday, and we'll bake some of the breads on Saturdays and the rest of them on Sundays. And it still worked out okay. It wasn't too bad.
That's cool.
Went through a lot of wood.
So when are you going to go full-time with this?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it would be feasible to do what we're doing as we're doing it full-time. I can't picture it from a whole bunch of different standpoints. First of all, I don't know if there's a market in our locality to sell as much bread as you'd have to sell to make it a full-time thing.
Yeah.
Like, you'd have to be doing this every day. You'd have to, like, and we're doing it without refrigeration. We're doing it without even a bloody bread mixer. Everything's is being done. Everything's been done by hand. So, like, up to, you know, batches of bread that are, you know, total batch weight of maybe 30 kilos, that's too much for your arms. It kills your arms. And my arms right now, from doing my regular job, which is working in an in-store bakery, are already destroyed from that. And so coming and doing this, it's a little bit kamikaze.
Yeah.
You know,
kind of
so,
being like a primitive Egyptian baker or something.
Yeah, I mean, if there was a, when you, like, just to go back to your question about doing it full time, if there was some tweaking of, you know, I guess we would have to increase our customer base by, you know, maybe, I'm just estimating, you know, fivefold or something like that, in order to do it, you know, kind of on a full-time basis. We'd have to get at least a half-decent spiral or some sort of bread mixer in here,
right.
Get the proper wiring for it, probably get certified as a, you know, as some sort of commercial kitchen in a residence, and I don't even know if that's possible in this, it's, you know, there's all kinds of issues involved with it that are just sort of, they're, there are almost things you don't want to find out because, you know, probably they'd say, no, you can't do this.
Yeah.
And they'd shut you down. And that, you know, I've been sort of, you know, every time we do a bake, we try to make it as clean as we can. So we have a basement kitchen, but it gets destroyed, you know, flour everywhere.
So you kind of look over your shoulder every time you do a bake, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So it's just kind of, like, I think probably what's more likely on the horizon would just we would look for a retail space,
yeah,
and try to make a go of it as a, you know, a retail bakery with perhaps a wood-fired oven component to it. But that's the other thing too. If you're baking all your products in a wood-fired oven, it's really hard. I don't find it. You know, like once the romance has worn off, like I really long for the days where you just walk in and press a button and boom, the gas turns on, you adjust the temperature and off you go. I mean, there's something to be said for that as well.
Yeah, there's so many more variables, I bet.
Oh man, like there, it's like we've always struggled with getting the amount of loaves in with the available heat. That's like the biggest stress factor, especially in the colder months, because, you know, it's just your BTUs are challenged by the elements, right?
Yeah.
And but, you know, some days it's great and sometimes it's not, and luckily for us, we've never had a crash, you know, where things were just a complete disaster. We've had, I would say, probably every bake that we do, there's at least one variety of bread that comes out looking, to my eyes, like crap.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we still sell it, and people like it, and I think we've pushed the envelope with that a few times, where we've sold things to people that, you know, we didn't really feel that great about selling them, but we did it anyways, right? And I don't like doing that. That really bothers me. And the oven is I'm not a poor workman blames his tools, right? But you have to work with what you have, and it is a wonderful piece of equipment. But it does have its limitations, and especially if you're, you know, if you have ever baked in a professional setting where, you know, where there's proper equipment and a proper professional oven, even though there's lots of crappy professional ovens out there, when you're baking with a steady supply of BTUs, you know, meaning cooking with gas, or
yeah,
baking with gas, you don't have some of the same worries. So if you have to turn something down and then turn it back up again for something else, that's what you do.
Yeah.
With this setup, you can't do that, and it requires a lot of it's empirical. You have to just do it a lot before, and we're only doing it once a month. I think if we did have an opportunity to do it more than, you know, like at least once a week or several times a week, I think I would become a much, much better oven operator, or wood-fired oven operator. So, I don't know.
But it does seem to sharpen your skills, though, to some extent.
Yeah, it does. But still, like it's funny because there was a picture that I put up on the blog of this organic spelt that I actually made in my electric oven indoors,
uh-huh,
and it looks really nice. Like, you know, I'm not patting myself on the back, but it came out really beautiful. So I did the same loaves in the wood-fired oven, and they came out looking nice, but nowhere as sort of you know, evenly colored and you know, with the slashes, you know, as artfully done, because you're rushing it out outside, and it's kind of like, you know, like baking on a football field. You know, imagine doing something like baking while there's a soccer practice going on or something like that, where, you know, it's not the same as being in an enclosed space where it's super, super controlled.
Yeah.
Or more controlled. So there's I don't know.
How far ahead do you plan your bake? I mean, you kind of have to figure out, okay, who's going in first and whatever, so.
Yeah, well, you know, just sort of normally the leaner breads, you know, the things like baguettes.
Yeah.
The miches, you know, the big loaves that can stand pretty high heat, that have to be in for a long time. Those sorts of things go in first. Most of the naturally leavened, like the sourdoughs, are obviously going to going in before breads that might have, like, there's only two breads we're doing right now that have commercial yeast. One of them is raisin bread, and the raisin bread is, it's pretty rich, like there's eggs in it. It's almost like a brioche. There's there's butter in it, and so that one goes in last, and that one goes in once the temperature has fallen well below 400 degrees, because you'd burn it. It would come out too dark. So you play around with it a little bit, but there's most of the planning that I do is calculating the size of the batches, and that has to do with the people that are ordering. So, you know, the week of, we send out this email with this list of breads that we have to offer, hoping that people will get back to us as soon as possible so we can start putting the numbers together. But what actually usually happens is almost invariably, you know, because people are busy, there's a certain crowd that does get back to you early. Okay, I'll take three of these and two of these and so on. You can start to put your numbers together. But I would say more than 50% of the list don't respond, and my wife follows up on telephone on Friday evenings and Saturday mornings. So it's not until the day before that you're actually baking that you get your final numbers. You know, I've got all the formulas on spreadsheets, so I just have to hit a number to get the, you know, what my scaling weights are going to be for all the different ingredients. That's not a problem, but it's calculating leavens. You know, like if it was just all commercial yeast and you're doing straight doughs, no problem. You could almost do it several hours before the bake, right? Yeah. But with some of the stuff you're trying to build, you know, building sourdoughs, right? You want to build your sourdoughs to the correct proportion with the correct numbers for flour and water with your mature culture, right? And that makes, and it's hard to explain that to people. And I think, quite frankly, most of them are, they may be interested in purchasing this bread, but they're not interested in hearing what your problems are with your builds, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not so sure I want to be telling people all that information anyways. Like, it's okay that, you know, that they know, you know, that it's, you know, as much natural ingredients and as much organic stuff as possible, but the math and the actual procedures, like, leave as much mystery as you can.
Yeah, otherwise, you know, it won't be as exciting.
That's right, because I, you know, there's this, I hear back and forth when I'm reading all these different books, Jeffrey Hamelman, Daniel Leader, like, they're fantastic books. I'm not criticizing the books at all, but there's sort of a seesaw, you know, there's a lot of people that I think that would like to preserve the idea of the baker being the alchemist, and then there's a whole other group of people that say no, the baker's not the alchemist. The baker's, you know, it's a craft, and there's science behind it, which I'm sort of halfway in between it, you know.
Yeah.
If there's people that want to that get a kick out of looking at it that way, I'm not gonna ruin their illusions.
Yeah, it reminds me of when I went for an interview one time with a chef, and he was a bit rigid on his thought pattern. And I said, "Why do you want to come and work here?" And I said, "And why do you want to cook?" And I said, "Well, you know, my dad's an artist, so I kind of feel that cooking is art." And he goes, "That's bullshit." And I'm like, "What?"
Because there is two sides to it. There's the dreamy side, the artistic side, and there's the sort of the no-nonsense. I've run into both types of people all through all the, you know, the years and you know, people I've worked with in bakeries, and you know, the hard-ass realists are sort of, yeah, they disdain that. That's because they see it as a grind, or they see it as a different thing. They don't see it as an artistic expression. Yeah, and I've run into tons of people that were extremely artistic that still profess the disdain for it. So
yeah,
it's difficult to I don't know. I've always considered myself an artistic person, but it's just, you know, you have to kind of, if someone asked you a question like that and you gave them, that's a very honest answer that you gave that chef.
Yeah,
you kind of walked into his body blow, I guess.
But, well, I didn't get the job, nor did I really want to work with a guy like that. It was so rigid, so I said, "Screw it."
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point.
Let me fumble my way through the rest of the business.
Yeah.
How did you get started baking? What was your introduction to the world of bread?
I guess doing stuff at home. I grew up. on my mom's side, they're Ukrainian, and there was, you know, my mom was always doing the typical, you know, cabbage rolls and pierogies and all that, the home cook stuff that she missed. And I guess the way my parents thought that, you know, their kids should be raised is that everybody should know how to cook. So quite early on, I have two brothers, and I'm the oldest, but all three of us were in the kitchen, you know, not forced into the kitchen, but definitely encouraged to, you know, produce meals that were of a certain standard, like that, meaning that the family could eat them, you know. So by the time we were, you know, around, you know, early adolescence, it was part of the response, your weekly responsibility, that, you know, on Tuesday you had to make supper, and on Thursday it would be, you know, one of the other brothers, whatever. And so it was at least once a week you had to produce something. And so all three of us cook. Like, neither of my brothers ever got into baking. I actually don't remember how I got into baking. Because I made my living for quite a long time as a itinerant rock and roll guitar player. Uh-huh. And eventually that dried up, you know. And it wasn't because I was such a lousy guitar player. But you know, just the scene changed, and I ended up getting a job in a bakery, and it was a really, really horribly dirty, off, you know, exploitive, almost horrible boss, as you can imagine. And I didn't last there very long, and I didn't do much baking, but there was a couple of people that I worked with there that knew how to do, you know, laminated pastries. They are famous, this particular place, for their Danish. And so I learned how to do rolling. And I learned how to mix, because they were also doing donut mixes and muffin mixes and things like that. It's pretty basic. They weren't doing any bread. And around the same time, I was baking bread at home with my girlfriend, who, you know, was now my wife. And it just sort of grew from there. And so I started to do that for, you know, to earn my living. And I would go from basically working in one shop per year, getting as much as I could soak for, you know, an hourly wage, and then move on to somewhere else. And it was mostly pastry and cake shops I worked in. I didn't actually start making bread on a, you know, like a commercial scale, or like selling to the public, until I started working in grocery stores, and which was sort of a logical development, because grocery stores at the time, this would have been, I guess, in the 80s, were offering more per hour than some of these smaller cake and pastry shops. So I just sort of drifted, you know, went higher and higher and higher, until I one day applied at one of these places and was accepted. And they put me on nights doing bread, and I didn't know anything about bread. But they, you know, the guy gave me a couple of pointers, and off I went. And it was all straight doughs. It was all pre-mixes or straight doughs. So I say scratch baking. It wasn't really anything that you would be proud of today, you know. But they had all, you know, their product line, from all the crusty breads and sovitals and whole grain breads, but it was all pretty, you know, like I said, straight doughs. You'd mix it up and throw the yeast and let it rise once, punch it, form it, and bake it. And you know, small production for that one particular store I was in. But I ended up, I was on nights for about a year, part-time, and still playing in the band. And then I saw there was some full-time job postings, and I tried to apply for them, and they said, no, you can't apply for those. You have to go through an apprenticeship. So I said, okay, well, if that's what it takes, because I was getting sick and tired of not making that much money. So I signed an agreement with the company and became an apprentice baker. And so that apprenticeship lasted about 4 years. And at the time, there was, you know, lots of scraping the floor and getting treated like garbage, like probably every apprentice has those types of stories. But now when I look back on it, I had a really, really good opportunity to work with lots of different ethnic backgrounds, and they all knew their little tricks of how to, you know, get the bread to rise, or how to, you know, do this little fold or whatever. And so by the end of it, I actually had a pretty good working knowledge of, you know, what goes on in a bakery, in a sort of a full-scale bakery, making everything from the pastry line to the bread stuff and decorated cakes. And where I ended up eventually was not as a bread baker, but I ended up as a cake decorator, and that's what I've done mainly in the as far as the grocery store stuff for the past, I don't know, 15 years or so.
Wow.
Now, I say decorating. It may not be what you think is decorating. You have to look at it from, you know, like the standpoint of a grocery store where it's very basic stuff. You're doing, you know, strawberry shortcakes all day, and that's all you do, strawberry shortcakes all day. And sometimes you may end up, if you're smart about it, you may end up having a career doing nothing but strawberry shortcakes and really trying willfully not to get involved in doing, you know, the kids' multicolored decorated birthday cakes, which is actually where I have ended up. And that's no fun because the way that the bakeries are set up that I work in are they're completely exposed to the public.
Yeah.
So the public is it's like you're a monkey on display and you're doing all, you know, you're making the rosettes and the flowers and the leaves and stuff and putting on the construction trucks on the cakes for young boys or whatever. And while the kids and the parents are watching you, and sometimes very critically, if they don't like what you do, they tell you right away.
Oh Lord!
So, which is not the way a bakery should be run. I've always been under the firm belief that a bakery should be, you know, behind closed doors, and that you bring the stuff out to the public.
Yeah, so you appreciate it more when you're getting it.
That's right, and it's sort of like, you know, you don't want to. You know, there was some quote I think from Winston Churchill that was, you know, the public should never see, you know, how sausages are made, and they shouldn't see how bills are being, you know, like how bills get passed in Parliament. And so it's sort of the same thing. It's great to eat a sausage. I appreciate a sausage, but I don't want to see all the stuff getting ground up and made into the sausage. It's sort of the same in a bakery, maybe not quite to the same extent, but bakeries are dirty, and you know, sometimes that's at odds with, you know, the wonderful products that you might see coming out of them. Not every bakery manager or bakery owner is as concerned about sanitation as they should be.
Yeah, well, we have a real big problem with sanitation in America. I think we're so over sanitized with everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're really funky underneath it, but nobody wants to admit it, so.
That's right, exactly, I know. Well, I mean, you don't have to sanitize everything. Just try to keep it swept up and clean and
yeah.
Make sure there's no rodents and,
oh, definitely,
you know, all that type of stuff. And I know, like, in New York City, I remember hearing a few years ago, there was all the blitzes that were going on with the health department going around and shutting people down. Exactly the same thing was happening here in Toronto, virtually around the same time, you know, because there was the, you know, all the Chinese food restaurants that, you know, their standards of sanitation are quite, how they view it is quite a bit different.
Oh, yeah.
And it sort of spread, and so, like, even grocery stores got, you know, had to have, you know, the green pass signs in the window and stuff. I think in a way it was good, but in another way it was sort of window dressing, you know, like, if they wanted to address the issues of sanitation, it went sort of a lot further than just, you know, some of the small things that they're doing. It's more like a mindset. If you're going to be clean, you know, you have to educate people about it. And there was really not a lot of education.
Well, I went to Montreal a few years ago, and I went into the supermarkets, and I was like, wow, man, they have, like, the best stuff here. Montreal's a great city. I mean, for me, it's like going to Europe in a way.
That's right, yeah, yeah, for
and,
sure.
And especially the bakeries were, like, pretty damn amazing. I mean, they had, like, incredible breads, and just the food is so different. I mean, you imagine you're crossing the border, and you go, whoa, where the hell am I, you know?
Yeah, you're in Canada now.
Yeah, holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? Quebec is a really, like, as a Canadian, and I don't, you know, the last time I was in Quebec was just recently when I drove down to Vermont, right? But the time before that I was in Quebec, like, as I live fairly far, I don't get to Quebec, and certainly not Montreal, the way I used to when I was growing up, because I lived in Ottawa, which is the nation's capital.
Yeah.
And Montreal is only about an hour away, so we used to go to the concerts, all the shows that used to come through Montreal, and, you know, and go to all the clubs and all the restaurants and stuff like that, and as far as the European thing, you're absolutely right about that, and it has a vibe to it that you couldn't buy in Toronto or most other places in Canada, because it's French, and it has this very It's earthy and
Gallic flavor.
Exactly. Yeah. I wish we could get there more often, and I certainly wish we could go there now as a baker. And you know, like I'm way behind the wave with all this other stuff. You know, in Jeffrey's book, and he talks about you know, James McGuire and the Mish, and I started looking. I've never even heard of James McGuire, and I was fascinated that there was this guy in Montreal that was doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
But it was long. He was his bistro had already shut down. Like I would, if it was still open, I would drive there probably tonight.
Yeah.
You know, there are some places like that in Toronto. There's a couple of French run establishments. One's called Bonjour Brioche.
Right.
Where it's a couple, and the fellow is from Paris, and they make brioche and croissant. They don't do any. It's more like a cafe, and they do a really big breakfast and brunch trade. And there's another guy, King Street, called Mark Touet, and he has a bakery bistro, and he does the quote unquote artisan bread thing, and another guy I've yet to visit. You know, I'm wrapped up out here in the suburbs in Scarborough, you know, so
yeah.
It's kind of, I'm in my own little world. Like, going to that course in February really opened, it was just, you know, getting to hang out with, you know, other bakers was really, really fun.
Yeah.
I'd love to do more of it.
Oh, I know, because I'm part of the Bread Bakers Guild, and I did a thing last winter for, like, holiday breads and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you meet all these amazing people, and the more I talk to, like, other people that I visited in Wales last year with these people I met online at Dan Lepard's site.
Yeah, yeah.
It was so cool, because now a friend of mine, the guy who initiated the thing, he's got his own micro bakery, so I'm going to talk to him, too, and see how he's doing, because it was funny, we were at a rugby hall where we were doing this whole bread baking thing, and they had these really tough rugby-type Gaelic talking guys there.
Yeah, yeah.
And they, like, were kind of sizing me up because they heard it was, like, the only Yank there, and one guy who happened to live in, I guess, Florida or something, and he was visiting the family, you know? So they, like, really scared the shit out of me. These guys were monsters. I mean, it was, like, something out of... They kind of look like the characters from that movie, Great Expectations. I mean, beastly,
yeah, yeah.
Scary-looking guys, and they go, "What the fuck's this fucking bread?" And I'm like going, "Dude, man, please, you're scaring me."
That's great, though, that you get to, you know, going particularly out of country.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons I return to Stir the Pot so often. All those great interviews with all the American guys, but listening to Dan, I think I've listened to that interview you've done with Dan Lepard, I don't know, 20 or 30 times. I go over and over and over. It's just, it's so neat to his headspace. The guy, the fellow from Australia, what's his name, Graham?
Graham Pritchard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same thing. Like, they're, it's really, like, it's, there's some, real worldliness there, like sophistication, but not sophistication like nothing snooty. I guess that's part of, you know, maybe to do with their national character.
Yeah,
just a little really really close to the earth, and opinionated as hell. I like hearing strong opinions like that, especially.
Oh yeah, there's always like little fights going on down there in sourdough country in Australia.
Yeah,
it gets pretty. It's pretty rough and tumble down there.
Yeah, I think, you know, on that site, just the pictures alone, not to mention the video. The videos that they have are of the way that they work. It's so different than,
yeah.
Like I'm watching this stuff and picking up tricks. Like it's not like being there, but it's really really neat. Seeing how these guys do their stuff. It's,
yeah, there
really
was like
different.
Those guys who were doing that Malawa.
Malawa
that
bakery.
That single.
The single fold.
Yeah,
that's
amazing.
You know what? When I went to Vermont, like, you know, Jeffrey's showing everybody how he'd like us to mold, right? So it was fine. And actually, I've started to mold just the way he taught me, right?
Yeah.
But previous to that, I picked up that single fold Malawa thing,
yeah,
and found that it worked great. Like, the less you mess with the structure of, you know, what is referred to as the glutinous matrix,
right,
the better, because
yeah,
it's very delicate, particularly in sourdough bread. You can't be slamming them around on the table the way you can. It won't tolerate it the way a yeasted dough will, right? A yeasted dough will always come back because there's yeast in it, right?
Yeah.
It was really neat to see that, and it was artful as well, and plus it saved time. You're doing, instead of, you know, wrapping the dough up about three or four different ways and then, you know, molding it, he's doing super simple.
Yeah.
And the breads came out looking beautiful. And probably if you wanted to get really, really picky about it, if you slice into one of their breads, the structure of the bread is probably really, really evenly uneven, you know, with all those nice small and large holes spread out throughout the entire loaf. Yeah, there was a lot of things that those guys were doing. Another thing I noticed about the Australian bakers, and many of the sourdoughs were sourdoughs with stuff added to them.
Yeah.
Like lots of cheese breads, lots of sort of like, you know, the higher priced items that you're going to put, you know, which drives your ingredients prices up.
Sure. Well, I like cheese breads to a certain point, but I really like the really basic, like, especially the miche. I love miches. I worked at Boulet Bakery, and this French guy they had was a compagnon from France.
Right.
And he made, like, the most incredible breads. I mean, this guy had, like, a little French medallion, you know, on his chest, gold, you know, showing that he'd been a compagnon.
And
I was like,
yeah,
damn, this guy. And he was just, like, eating me apart, going, my God, you don't even know how to pull the dough out of the bowl. I'm like, what the hell did they teach you at school? I'm like, duh.
Yeah, they can. I was just talking to my dad just visited me recently, and we had, whatever bread that I'd made with olives, and there's I get quite often people ask me, how come you don't make an olive levain? And I don't try to put breads like that down, but really the way I prefer, I like to eat olives with the bread.
Yeah.
I find that when I put olives, like if you put olives in the bread, that the olives never taste as good as they did originally, and the bread never tasted as good as it could if you just made it as a bread. And yet when you pair them together and they end up together in your mouth, you know, that's the same with, meats. Like, I don't want to make a salami bread. I don't want to chop up salami
or
speck or any of those, like, really nice, you know, cured meats and put them in a bread. I want to make a sandwich out of the bread with the stuff.
Yeah, just a marriage.
That's right. It's exactly. I don't know. My phrase for stuff like this is yuppie bread. That's for people that think they're sophisticated. And by no means do I consider myself a sophisticated. I think I have pretty simple tastes. I'm not big on, you know, fancy meals or anything. I just like good food, right?
Sure.
So, but yeah, the olive levain thing. Because I've had people. Have you tried so and so's olive levain? I went to this one place and I bought a loaf and I tried it. Yeah, it's okay, but it doesn't turn my crank.
Yeah.
You know,
well, you've been doing a spelt bread, and I'm so jealous because I've been trying, and I've been to Switzerland. My sister uses that stuff like it's, you know.
Yeah, you're telling, you were, yeah.
It's torture. I can't figure this stuff out yet. Still, you know.
Well, are you trying to make a spelt bread out of 100% spelt?
Well, yeah, I did, and it,
okay,
you know, it sort of came out okay, but then I also noticed that it dries out really quick too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. This, my adventures with spelt, I have to tell you, they just started, because I just started, you know, I was thinking to myself, I should start, you know, doing, because I'm big on rye, I'm big on wheat.
Yeah.
But the spelt thing, I just bought my first bag of spelt about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and on the label, it's organic spelt, but on the label it says organic light spelt, and so I'm looking at this.
Yeah, so it's a whiter color, right?
Yeah, I said, don't you have any, I want whole grain spelt. She says, I'm sorry, we're out of that right now, so I thought, okay, I'll buy this. And I worked up a formula, and I thought, I know for sure I'm not going to dive in and start making 100% right off the bat. So I made, I think, the first batch I made, I think it was 50-50. So it was 50% white, all-purpose flour, and 50%.
Right.
And it came out great. So I'm calling, maybe I should, you know, explain that to, because this lady that bought it, she said, oh, I got your spelt loaf, but it was just a white loaf. And I'm going, well, yeah, it's the same color.
Yeah, it's a tough flour, but it has an incredible flavor. I mean, you can make crepe bread and still it tastes good.
It also leavens, like it ferments. It takes to fermentation really, really well.
Yeah,
that's what I noticed. Because I ended up making, I think it was a stiff levain with that, and it really grew nicely. It popped right up. It's really good.
Yeah, well, I'm on some of the German bread forums, and they make incredible breads, and they had these rye breads with like leeks and stuff. And I tried making it, and when I ended up making it, it was like crap because you know it's hard to get rye here in the States for some stupid reason. It's like you can't get you can get stuff from King Arthur and stuff, but you know you gotta wait for the stuff to be delivered. And
that's an expensive way to buy flour.
Yeah,
I was kicking myself the whole week I was down there. I kept on saying because I drove down in a truck, right? And I was saying to myself, well, the least I should do is buy at least four bags, 20 kilo bags or whatever the poundage is down there of the Sir Galahad because it's really, really nice flour. It's non-brominated. And then the last day I completely forgot and I drove away and I'm about 4 hours out of Vermont and I'm finally realizing, oh yeah, you didn't buy. And it's not that it would have been a couple hundred bucks for the flour, no big deal. But I'm there. I might as well bring it back to Canada with me, right? And I completely forgot. I was so pissed off.
That, or they'll stop you at the border and say, "What is that, Coke?"
Well, it's really funny when I got to the border, before we left, because we were growing these levains and working with them all week. So of course, we got to take some home. So Jeffrey supplied us with these little tubs that screw on lids, and we have each of us have about maybe 25 to 35 grams. Of the leaven, one it's dark because it's got the rye leaven, the other one's lighter with the liquid levain, and I had them on my dashboard. So I drive across the border, and they never even looked at them, and I kept on looking at them and going, because I wanted to have them in the sun because the sun was going down, right?
Yeah.
And so I get to the border, and before all the way through Vermont, because it's hilly, you're driving up and down, and it's really nice. I kept on looking at them, going, you should take those down, put them in the glove compartment. Because for sure they're going to say something about it. And so I forgot all about it. Got to the border. They didn't even look at them. And they were asking me questions like, do you have any alcohol? Do you have any firearms? Do you have any tobacco? And they asked that question about five times. And I said, no, I don't have any alcohol. I don't have any firearms. I don't have any tobacco. What were you doing in Vermont? Well, I was attending a bread course. Oh, really? So I was semi-interested in that. And I just so happened to have that big niche with me sitting in the front seat because I wanted to look at it, right? So I'm driving home. So she kind of looks in the window, she waves me on. She gets me over to the Canada Customs guy, and the Canada Customs guy asks me exactly the same questions. And he says, do you have any alcohol or tobacco? And then I realized, oh, yeah, I bought a six-pack of beer, and I didn't drink them all, so I brought one beer back, and it's stuffed deep in my pack. And I'm thinking, should I say that I have this beer? Because now the guy's asking me tons of questions. He's looking at me suspiciously. Where are you from? He's a Quebecois, and I'm a Maudit Anglais, right? I'm from Toronto, and like all Quebecers hate Torontonians, right?
Oh man!
So now I felt like I was lying because I had this one bottle of beer, and he kept on saying alcohol, firearms, or tobacco. And I said, no, I don't have any alcohol. And finally, he waved me through, but he looked like he was hungry for my ass. Like he wanted to bust somebody, and I'm really glad it didn't happen. But the whole time, these little levens are sitting there, looking probably to someone who doesn't know, quite suspicious. So if they did open up the back and there was all that flour, who knows what would have happened?
No kidding. They probably, those poor levens were sweating it all the way back.
Oh yeah, they probably would have dumped it. That would have been the end of that. But speaking of rye flour, I have a supplier who actually is only up the road from here. It's a place called Grain Enterprises.
Uh-huh.
And they're sort of it's a warehouse. It's like they mill some stuff and they're like a middleman for other things. And all the rye, I've been able to get really, really good quality stone ground whole grain rye flour.
Wow.
And so that's what I've been using ever since I've started doing this thing at home. And
do
I'm
you ever
quite
sift it?
I beg your pardon?
Do you ever sift the flour if you want to make it?
Never.
No.
Never rye flour. Huh. There's been a couple of formulas that I've found that ask for light rye flour or medium, and I have to say that quite when I look at those formulas, I become less interested in it because I don't want to bake stuff with light rye flour. It's not that great.
Yeah, it's kind of like white stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't have any flavor. It's all the good, all the minerals and everything been sifted or milled out of it. So
yeah, it's what's really strange about all the German things, though. They make these incredible breads. They seem to have like 18 different like types of flour that you're like, dude, man, how much rye do you guys have over
and
there?
And this is all rye flours you're talking about.
Yeah,
right?
They have like different grades of the ryes over there.
Wow,
it's crazy because like they're totally into like mixing like dark, middle, light, and then lighter.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Maybe I should because I would like to like I make two rye breads right now. I'm making Jeffrey's 40% caraway rye out of the book.
Right.
And the Vulkornbrot, and people like it. Like, there's a market for the bowl. There's a market for the 40%. I'm really happy about that. And that was actually probably one of the best things about going to that course was just understanding how to work with rye a little better. And I had some inklings of it before, nothing beats hands-on. So when you go down and do something like that,
yeah.
And especially, you know, dealing with leavening, you know, 100% rye bread, it's really different. It's more like a batter. You end up with a bread, but it's not like working a crusty or a pain au levain or a baguette or anything like that. It's completely different. You can't approach it from the same way, and some of the fermentation requirements are radically different. And it's good to learn that, and it's nice to find. I notice, you know, in almost every interview that you do with an American, you know, bread personality, for lack of a better, you ask them the same questions, and it's I have the same fascination for it because I think rye bread is the potential in terms of like a market for it it's there because it tastes so good. Like it's just,
yeah, and it's really understated
and plus I think people like there are some German bakeries here in town. There's one in particular called Dimpfelmeyer. They've been making
I actually have heard of them.
I beg your pardon?
I think I've actually heard of them.
Yeah. They you know what they do? They sell all their stuff is cut into 1 pound blocks and sold in sliced, wrapped in plastic. Like they have a very, very, I would say, a non-artisan, very grocery store packaging sort of mentality. So when you look at their stuff, it looks good, it looks presentable, but you don't really. And it's in all grocery stores in Canada. You see it everywhere. They have a huge, huge market for it, and it's really, really good bread. And they make an organic line. They make a line without any yeast. They make lines without any. No wheat flour at all, like 100% rye. But you don't get a sense of the baked loaves because they're all chopped up and sliced, right? So they're packaged. And that's unfortunate, but it's good in a way because like the people that know good bread will go and buy Dimpfelmeyer bread. No problem, it's all good quality. There's no question about it. But you don't get the old-time vibe. And I'm always looking for that. I like to find bakeries that are still, you know, family owned, where it's definitely local. Like it's not that I'm jumping on the bandwagon. It's just easier for me. And there's a German baker that I work with. He's a decorator. He's a real character. He's from Berlin, and he told me about a place that's about a 10-minute drive north from here. It's called Montmartre, which is the wrong pronunciation, but that's what everybody calls it. Montmartre Bakery. It's been there since the 50s. It's this little brick building in an industrial park, and so I started going there, and like it's a really, really cool place. And they don't sell anything there that's really outstanding in terms of, you know, like they, one day a week they sell sourdough rye bread, and the rest of the time they're making straight doughs. But if you want a good pie or a strudel or something like that, you go there on a Saturday, and the place is beset. It's so packed full of people buying up everything that they have to, all the pretzels are gone, all the bread is gone. At 10 o'clock in the morning, the place is cleaned out.
Huh.
And the old German baker, the guy that runs the place, who's the owner, is just standing there, you know, in his baker's whites, all sweaty, smoking a cigarette, ushering people in the door and helping them out. It's really, really neat to see that. It's, I know I got off topic from Rybridge, but...
Yeah, but you know, I mean, in New York, I mean, you think this is like the Jewish capital, the second capital, and there really isn't a Jewish baker anymore. I mean, I've been talking a lot about Jewish guys and the whole culture. It's pretty much gone in New York, you know?
Yes, that's I've read that. I had an inkling of that. I'm trying to remember what one of the books I was reading. It could have been Peter Reinhardt's Bread Baker's Apprentice. I think it might have been that one where... I don't remember the book where the fellow was walking down the street with an old baker and he was pointing at the tenements and saying there used to be a baker here and there used to be a baker here, basically a baker for every, you know, 500 people.
Yeah.
And that's all gone, and that's so bad.
That's what I find really strange about America. It's like in Europe, I always tell the American bakers, man, there's like bakeries everywhere, you know. There's like no. I mean, it's competition, but still, it's like you got your spot, you go to.
That's right, and that's a good thing. The competition is a good thing. Like you know, like having, you know, I'm totally like, I work in a grocery store, so I have intimate hatred for big box shopping. Like I think there's nothing worse than that. You want as many bakeries as possible in a square mile or in a given neighborhood, because it makes things interesting, and one guy will do something and the other guy will copy him and maybe do it better and steal his business. Well, you know what? That's free enterprise. That's how it's supposed to work.
Yeah.
It's not like what the big box is not free enterprise. That's like, I don't know, socialism for the rich or something. I don't know.
Well, but I kind of always wonder if people, you know, with all this greening of the world supposedly, if people really are understanding what's going on and if we're going to ever change, or is it just part of the population who really cares, or the rest doesn't really give a shit because they're too worried about getting the buck, you know?
I don't know.
I'm sort of pessimistic about the whole picture.
So I have a hard time with that because I would like to be optimistic, but, you know, there's it's gone so far to one extreme with, you know, cheap, fast food. And if you want to buy good food, you have to pay more than you will for cheap, fast food. That's a real problem. There's no incentive for people that don't know any better to eat really good food.
Well, how are you guys on farmers markets up there in where you are?
Well, it's funny. There's a lady that we know that runs a farmers market on the other side of town. It's called Dufferin Grove, and they actually have a website. I think it's called dufferingrove.ca. It's a very, very community-oriented urban space that has basically been taken over by a bunch of do-gooder people that wanted to have a farmer's market, that wanted to have some communal bread ovens, and so they, you know, they. This is before, long before I ever did my oven. She got an oven mason to build two ovens out there.
Wow.
She appropriated some city space, put a Hobart mixer in there, got some bakers in there, and they're baking bread the same way I do. I don't know if they do it every day, but I think they do it several times a week, and they have a farmer's market out there. I've been to the farmer's market. It's fantastic. It's really, really, really good. You know what the problem is for me? Is that most farmer's markets don't work on the schedule that I'm on. They're always on farmers markets on Friday. I can't do it on Friday. I have to be at work on Friday.
Yeah.
Or they do it on Thursday. Same thing. Like the Dufferin Grove does theirs on Thursdays. It's, and I've checked out other farmers markets that were just too, what's the word? I don't want to put them down because I think farmers markets are great. I would love to get involved with one, but I haven't seen the right, the timing hasn't been right. Like, maybe that's the best way to put it. All the farmers markets that I've seen, they didn't appeal to me, mainly because of the days that they're set up to, because they're normally one day a week affairs, right? That's how they work up here and how they work in the States. But
no, they're like three days a week, I guess, now in the
city. Okay, yeah. Well, there's a farmers market downtown that runs every Saturday. It's called the St. Lawrence Market. It's a very famous commercial market. And on one side of the street, there's always a farmer's market. And about 2 years ago, when I first started selling bread, no, it was longer ago, because I've been selling bread long. It was maybe 3 or 4 years ago. We went down there on a Saturday morning to see what was what, to see. And I was really unimpressed by the breads I saw there. And I didn't, it was just a lot of really crappy looking bread, a sea of gray and brown.
Wow.
And I saw this great big huge miche, and I was like, wow, this is great. And so I went up to it, and the guy was, you know, standing there selling stuff. I said, can I hold this? Can I touch it? And he said, sure. And I picked it up, and it must have weighed less than 2 pounds.
Wow.
It was this giant loaf of air.
Yeast and bread.
Yeah. And I walked away just sort of shaking my head. And I later found out, yeah, you can rent a table down there for, I think it was $50. And we did the math for it. We'd make a little bit of money going down there. But you know what? By that time, we were ensconced doing our thing here,
yeah.
and this is where we've remained. So it's
and it's your place.
Exactly. I have some, you know, part of the problem that of, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, when you work for an employer, you know, you have to lend your brain and your hands to them for 8 hours a day. And
mine's more like 12 or 13.
Okay, all right. So, but there's never the assurance that they're going to return it in an unmolested condition, right?
Yeah.
So when you work for an employer, you have this always this lack of control, that they want you to do things that you don't want to do.
Yeah.
And you know, of course, that's the main reason that people open their own businesses, because to have some you know, some semblance of control in their life. And it's not like I'm a big control freak. I just, you know, like I'd like to be able to set my own terms for something. And I have to say that, you know, doing it here, I mean, I'm complaining about the oven, and I'm complaining about the email list of people not getting back to me. But beyond that, it's my show. Again, it's me and my wife bickering at worst, and at best, it's me and my wife working together, doing something that we both love,
uh-huh.
and making a few bucks at it. So I mean, I really can't complain.
And do you kind of find yourself in a zen kind of way when you're baking? Is there like a certain place that you're at when you're physically baking in your mind?
If I'm really lucky, Jeremy.
Yeah.
If I'm really, really lucky. Sometimes it's, you know, I've had days where everything goes wrong. And like one thing after another goes wrong. This goes wrong, that goes wrong. And that's obviously not what you want. But yeah, sometimes, you know, we've done bakes where, because we're baking out of doors, right? And when the rain or the snow is coming down, I try to put up a tarp. We've done bakes before where, you know, things were really, really brutal in terms of weather, and we get out there and all of a sudden, you know, like the clouds part and the sun comes down and the wind stops, and it's kind of like, yeah, this is all worth it, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, and mixing is really, despite me complaining about, you know, it destroying my arms, because I try not to, I like rather let the dough knead me rather than me kneading the dough. Well, like David Carradine or something, I don't know. But sometimes it's fun when you're up early, you've got a coffee going, got some tunes happening on the computer, or sometimes no tunes, just complete silence. It's quite nice.
And the birds.
It's very pleasant. Yeah, yeah. Early in the morning, like being up at that time making something is quite nice.
Yeah.
I'm not a super spiritual, or definitely not religious, but there is a quality to it that's very harmonious, you know. And then again, you know, fast forward 12 or 16 hours later, when I'm in bed and my wife is returning from the last delivery, and she's got this big wad of cash, and she gets into bed, and we're sitting there counting it, or just talking. Well, it's not even so much that; it's more the story she hears, because she's always the one that comes back with the stories. Oh, Kathy Quinn loved that meat. She was so happy when she saw that bread. Blah 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 blah. So it's you know, like that's non-monetary. It's got nothing to do with money.
Yeah.
But it's very, that's a rewarding thing. You know, like this sort of counting the days take and talking about, you know, the people that you pleased with the thing that you made. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, definitely good. Pleasure factor in baking bread.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, as a chef, for me, it's like, I can't stand working with waiters, and especially waiters. I think they're just a nuisance to the world.
Yeah, I think
I'll probably be shot by one soon, but You know, bread baking is such a solitary kind of thing that in a way it's kind of like, so you can really meditate on not thinking about horrible things like, oh God, how many plates are in the warmer? Oh shit, how much shit do I have to make for these people?
Yeah.
It's a totally different mindset. Well, you know, as we were talking, I was thinking about all the other people, the blogs that we're all sort of connected to, like Susan and Wild Yeast.
Oh, she's incredible, man. So I think I wrote something recently. When I'm, you know, kind of at odds or not really, I'm not sure what I should do, I always go to her blog, and I'll always see something or read something that just fires me up. She has a really... And I've always teased her, you should open up a place. I know she's you know, a health practitioner or something like that. And she does it strictly as a hobby. It's neat to see, I mean, you know, and really what I'm doing is just a glorified hobby. I'm not really making my living from it. I'm just fantasizing. And I would like to someday, and I know you're the same way, and you want to open up a bake shop someday.
Yeah.
But it's neat to see somebody doing it so well, that has such a good flair for it, that's just, you know, they're just out there, and I think that's fantastic. I'm really, really happy that that there's this little cyber community of people
baking together
that most likely, you know, like in the case of Sue, I doubt I'll ever be out on the West Coast to look her up.
Yeah.
It would be nice.
Well, I was just thinking about that because, you know, I'd gone to Wales to meet all these crazy English
that's amazing that you've done that. That's incredible.
And, you know, I thought about it. I said, you know, since the dollar's so shitty, I should figure out a way to get all these people to come over here. I just got to find an oven. So I said, Canada's not too far.
Well,
come over and visit David.
Someday our renovation started today. They just started digging today, right?
Yeah.
So I don't even have access to my oven right now. So it's going to be a few months, but who knows? Like if it would be fun, let's put it that way. It'd be fun to play host to a weekend of people coming up and
from all over the world.
And some sort of itinerary. Yeah, I would host that, definitely.
Yeah, well, they're doing one in France in I think June or July with my friend Brad over there.
That lucky
bastard. He's got a shed.
Is it going to be based around a wood-fired oven?
Oh, yeah, he's got this beautiful oven in his chateau house from, like, the 12th century or something.
Really?
And he lives in this community in the middle of nowhere near between Switzerland and France and, I guess, between Geneva and Lyon. And it's just, like, I'm so jealous. And, like, my friend Mick from Wales is going there for a few days. And, I'm just bummed out that I can't go. Because, man, we had such a great time last year. We were drinking schnapps that my brother-in-law made and partying every night. And I'd have to go run through the woods and try to figure out where the hell I was, you know. So, yeah, it's
that
fun.
Sounds like a lot of fun, Jeremy. I wish I had my vacations are normally spent car camping.
Uh-huh.
You know, in a tent. And I love it, too, or canoe trips or things like that. I wish I had the money and the time to go overseas or to go abroad, especially for connected with food or connected with baking in particular. That would be just a riot. I can't imagine how much fun it would be.
Yeah, well, next year I'm going to have hopefully 3 months off from work, which would be really great. And I want to go down to Australia and see the guys, John Downs and all those guys. Check them out and really do a big post about that.
Yes. Go work with them for a while. At least for two. Get them to, you know, bake alongside them for at least a couple of weeks.
I mean, yeah, that's what Graham's son, Mady, was telling me. He said, you could do it like a working holiday. I said, wow, that would be great.
Well, to a certain point, it would. I mean, it's got to be your holiday too, right?
Yeah.
But if that's what you consider your holiday is, you know, pounding out bread.
Well, actually, more power to you. It's a weird thing, but I do that on holidays. Whenever I go to my sister, it's like, can we go get some flour today? You know, and she's like, okay.
Yeah. Well, our family has a cottage north of Toronto here. It's about a 2 or 3 hour drive, and it's pretty basic. It's got plumbing and stuff, but it's pretty basic. And when I go up there, I always bake. And I always, for I don't know what it is, if it's the air or the water or just my state of mind, almost everything I bake up there turns out really, really great. And it's just in a little, tiny, crappy, 50-year-old electric oven that only holds one loaf of bread at a time. I've made bagels up there. I've made fantastic bread. Some really, really, some of the best breads that I think I've ever made were made up there, and just made it, you know, in really cramped quarters. Not a lot of, you know, it's the same thing. I gotta go down into town, buy like a tiny little 5 kilo bag of, you know, grocery store flour, and it just comes out fantastic. I like baking on vacation. It's probably one of the, if I had the opportunity to go to one of these places where there was more people like that, I don't know what I would do. I'd probably make a big fool of myself.
Nah.
Drink too much schnapps and
I got a question for you. What where is your last name from? Applin?
Oh, Applin, okay, on my dad's side, they're British.
Oh, okay.
And they're from Devon, England. And apparently, Applin is an offshoot of the name Llewellyn, which is a Welsh name.
Ah.
Yeah, so, my grandfather came to Canada, I guess, in the 20s. He came from a seaside town called Tynemouth, which is famous for making ships and boats. It was like, you know, one of these channel villages or towns.
Right.
And he came here to seek his fortune, and he married an American lady. My grandmother was from Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the Applin side of the family.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that's her. And it's the type of name that always gets misspelled. It's normally spelled, you know, instead of A-P-L-I-N, it's normally spelled A-L-P-I-N.
Yeah, I always do that because, you know, either I'm drinking too much wine while I'm writing my posts or I'm thinking about the Alps.
Thinking about the Alps, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always been misspelled, but I've, you know, just my last name, what am I going to do?
Yeah. Well, we really do have a lot of things in common, but one, I think, is that we're both Iggy Pop fans, so that's really cool.
Oh, yeah. Did I tell you about the note that I wrote Iggy Pop?
Yeah,
I was on, you know what, that was a long time ago. That was after American Caesar came out, and I really got into American Caesar. And this singer that I had, who was even a... He was a way bigger fan of Iggy Pop. When Iggy Pop came to town one time, he hired a bunch of musicians and did it and just sort of played at one of the clubs. And this son of a bitch never even told me. This lead singer I was playing with at the time never told me. And I was so like, how could you do that, man? Anyways, this guy was more of a poser than a singer. And it turned out that he wanted to be part of a motorcycle group, right? Like an outlaw motorcycle, like the Hells Angels, right? And I could not believe that somebody would want to hang out with those guys rather than musicians. So I was out. So him and I just ended up not seeing eye to eye, and eventually the band broke up. But at one point, we were supposed to do a gig somewhere, and he just didn't bother to show up. And I just thought, that's the most unprofessional, non-musician type of thing that somebody could do. And I think on the back of American Caesar, Iggy wrote, if you want to write me, you know, and I'll write you back. He definitely wrote that. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to write Iggy and see what he has to say about this situation. So I wrote him a little note saying, you know, we got this showcase coming up, and, you know, got some record companies coming out or whatever it was, right? And then this guy is going off and hanging out with his biker buddies all the time. What do you think? And like, the answer was obvious, right? But I wanted to hear it from Iggy.
Of course.
So about a year and a half goes by. In the meantime, the band breaks up, right? But a year and a half goes by, and then one day I get this envelope back, because I know what it was. Iggy said that you had to send him a self-addressed, right? Because, you know, you have to make it as easy as possible for him. So this envelope comes back. It's in my handwriting, and I look at it, and I go, that's my handwriting. And I flip it over. It says NYC, you know, the postmark on it. I go, who the hell is this? I open it up, and it's a scrap of paper that's not even, it's like torn from another piece of paper.
Oh, man.
It's dirty, and he can barely read it. It's written in pencil, but it's from Iggy. He says, I say kick the bum out, and he underlined the word out 3 times, right? And Iggy at the bottom. And I still have that.
Oh, man,
letter.
You better, like, cover that thing up.
Oh, yeah. And I told a mutual acquaintance of this lead singer, former lead singer, and I about this a couple of years later. I told him, and he says, you know what? Don't let Mark ever find out about that. He'll be crushed.
Classic.
I've never actually even seen him since then, so I haven't had the opportunity to. And if I did see him now, we'd probably have a laugh over it, because, you know, enough years have gone by. But at the time, I just remember getting such a charge out of this, because, you know, Iggy's he's definitely real.
Like, oh, for sure. Well, I saw him in concert one time, and I was kind of like this nerdy library kid, you know, wearing like pre-Nirvana like shirts, you know, and kind of cool jeans and big hiking boots, and everybody was all in this like new wave kind of crazed look, New York, junkie look, and Iggy and they had this really weird musician from Canada. Actually, I think he may have been from Toronto or Ontario.
Yeah, Iggy's got a big connection with Trump for some strange reason. I don't know why, but he does.
Well, this guy was dressed up like in a mummy outfit with a like a.
Oh, it was Nash the Slash. That's who
that's the
saw.
One, Nash.
Yeah. Nash the Slash. Yeah,
and
yeah.
He
yeah.
was great, man. I was like, who is
awesome.
This guy? And between the shows, Iggy would be like kind of sticking in his head out, checking out the crowd, and it was like it was I'm kind of spiritual about this thing because he looked straight at me and I looked at him and it was just kind of like whoa,
yeah,
we gelled.
Yeah, you gelled, yeah, because you were the only cool guy in the club.
Well, I was the guy who looked like a total weirdo, you know. I totally like did not mix with the rest of the crowd, so I guess it was cool for him.
I love that story. That's a great story.
Yeah. Well,
Well,
I don't want to keep you up all night because I'm sure you got to go work in the morning like I do.
Yep, I should get going. My wife was making gesticulating motions at me about half an hour ago, so I should go up and read my son a story probably.
Okay. Well, thanks for talking to me, David.
Oh, I really appreciate it. And you know what? Keep doing what you're doing. Send me the Mish formula, by the way.
Yeah, I'll try to make it more readable. Or
if I send you an Excel sheet showing the way that I do it, it's not that I'm so great at doing it, but I do it all the time.
Oh, I'm terrible at Excel. I just kind of like use other people's stuff. So
okay, I'll send you an Excel sheet with just an example of a small. Like, you know, a formula with only, you know, three or four ingredients, like
right.
most bread formulas are, and see if you can apply your put it into that format. If you can't, no big deal. I'll figure it out one way or the other, right?
Okay.
Because if I can make it easier for you, because one of the things we did on the very first day last story, and then we'll hang up. At King Arthur's, Jeffrey got the laptop, put it up, projected it up on the wall, and went through the whole process of Baker's Percent
right.
as applied with Excel. And I sat there and I'm watching it. I'm going, you know what? This is exactly how I do it at home. I don't know how I worked out because I'm just terrible at math. Right?
Me too.
Now, in that class, there was a couple of people that were like, they were really, really freaked by this because it was like a lot of cells, lots of numbers and stuff. And so I was watching, you know, this reaction. And finally, you know, when there was a little lull in the thing, I put up my hand. I said, listen, everybody, I'm a class A failure when it comes to math. I'm no good at all. But I'm telling you, work at this and master it. It may take you a few, you know, missteps and a few screwed up cells and going back and starting over again. But once you get it down, it's the easiest thing to do, and you'll actually find yourself sitting there doing it for fun. That's what I do for fun now.
Uh-oh.
I go, like a dunce with math, sitting down with Excel and going, okay, I want to calculate this, I want to change the percentage here, and I know how to do it. I have the power. I have, you know, because that's what Excel is. It's power, right?
Sure.
And it's one of the and I never ever used to go near Excel before. I used to look at it and go, ooh, I can't, but I have a brother who happens to be really good at math, and he sat down with me, and we screwed around with it enough for me to get my bearings with it, and once I did, it's very, very obvious. So let me send you one, see how you do with it. If you can apply the Mish to it, great, but still send me the Mish, because I want to try your formula.
Yeah, well, send me instructions, because I'm a bit of a knucklehead.
Well, I will try to make it as simple as I can.
All right, well, I'm pretty simple, so... All right,
anyway,
David.
Nice talking to you. It was great to finally meet on the telephone. I hope
been
we get to see each other in the flesh someday soon, Jeremy.
Yeah, definitely.
All the best, and like I said, keep doing what you're doing. Don't stop.
Thanks. Happy baking.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye for now.